I assume you can. We get a says on the chat, we'll get started. Or even one yes on the chat. Okay, if Antonio can hear me, I assume everyone can. Well, the main topic for tonight is natural monopoly, or the myth of natural monopoly. And, you know, so far what we've talked about is, you know, have a lot of talk about the myth of free market monopoly, about how if you look at competition as the Austrians do, as a dynamic rivalrous process, you understand that a monopoly in the free market is essentially a red herring argument. And so when economists abandoned the more or less Austrian view of competition, they became, you know, hypercritical of markets. And at the same time, the economics profession came up with rationales or excuses for government creation of monopolies. So in the late 19th and early 20th century, we had the, especially in the early 20th century, we had the development within the economics profession of the vast literature on market failure, committing the Nirvana fallacy, comparing real world markets to some sort of unachievable utopian ideal, perfectly competitive equilibrium, and condemning markets, while at the same time inventing rationales and excuses for actual monopoly created by government. And the best example is so-called theory of natural monopoly. And there's nothing natural about it. The utilities, so-called electric power, natural gas, telephone, and so forth, were given franchise monopolies by governments. There's nothing natural about that. It was all artificial as an act of government interventionism. But the standard story in economics books is that economies of scale were being developed in a lot of industries. And as a result, these industries were evolving in such a way where one big firm was likely to monopolize, that one big firm that would achieve economies of scale first. And so the theory goes, and the talk of the textbook goes, that the government then stepped in and took advantage of the fact that we want economy to scale, lower cost per unit, but we don't want monopoly. Therefore, the government created monopolies, the story goes, by law and regulation, and then it regulated those monopolies in the public interest. That's the standard story. And I made a case in the article of mine that's on the syllabus that this is a pure myth, that this whole scenario never happened. To be charitable to the economics profession, what I would say is that the definition of competition changed. They went from the way that Adam Smith looked at competition, all of the Austrians looked at competition, to defining it more or less as an engineering relationship in terms of economies of scale and market structure, you know, increasing and decreasing returns to scale. And so if we had, you know, economies of scale, by definition, that was defined as a type of market structure that would lead to monopoly. So no longer was competition viewed as rivalrous entrepreneurial discovery behavior, but economies of scale. And so that's the basic story. And as I write in the article of mine, a lot of economists that were not necessarily Austrians caught on to this and thought there's something rotten here, there's something wrong here. And one of them was Harold Demsetz, the UCLA economist who I've mentioned before, who wrote an article in... let's see if I can give you the site. Well, actually, he has a book entitled Efficiency, Competition, and Policy, and it's one of the chapters in his book on the origins of the natural monopoly idea. And he says this, you know, six electric light companies were organized in the year 1887 in New York City. 45 electric light enterprises had legal right to operate in Chicago in 1907. Duluth, Minnesota had five electric lighting companies. He goes on to talk about competition was common and especially persistent in the telephone industry in the late 19th, early 20th century. Baltimore, Chicago, Cleveland, Columbus, Detroit, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis all had at least two telephone services. But eventually, AT&T was given a monopoly. So there was competition. There was vigorous competition in all of these industries. Electric power, when it was invented and commercialized, telephone services, and so forth. And of course, some of these industries, there were attempts to cartelize, to create cartels, but cheating always breaks up cartels, and it didn't really work. And one of the things I read across was one of the leaders of the whole idea of regulating natural monopolies in the public interest was the co-founder of the American Economic Association, Richard T. Ely. And he wrote a lot of magazine articles at the time, in the early 20th century, about this, and he put them all into a book. And so there's a lot of literature on this. And Ely at the time was teaching at Johns Hopkins University, which is in Baltimore, where I work right now. And so there was a lot of discussion of this whole idea of natural monopoly in Baltimore because of Ely and others in the early 20th century. And in the course of my research, I read across a book that described how in Baltimore and in the state of Maryland, where I am, how it came to be that we had a government-created franchise monopoly in electric lights and electric power. And there was a book about it called The Gaslight Company of Baltimore, the history of this company, which has evolved into Baltimore Gas and Electric later on in later years. To this day, it's still called BG&E, Baltimore Gas and Electric. And the history of that, of this particular company, is illustrative of how all the so-called public utilities came to be monopolies. And so this is sort of a reclusive book. You know, I dug it up in the Johns Hopkins Library years ago. I might have been the first person ever to read it. You know, it's very old. It was published in 1936 originally. But the story that is told is the exact same story that happened everywhere in the U.S. and in other countries, also in the creation of monopoly by government in the name of natural monopoly. And basically, it's an old story. What happened was there was vigorous competition in the electric light business once electricity became commercialized. And there were attempts to cartelize, didn't work. This gaslight company of Baltimore, which turned into Baltimore Gas and Electric, became a rent-seeking organization. They went to the legislature over and over again and tried to get companies that were seeking to enter the market in Maryland to get the government to not give them a license, a business license, to do business. So they tried to keep the competition out that way. But when monopoly finally did appear in the state of Maryland and in Baltimore, here's how it appeared according to this book. It says, in 1890, a bill was introduced into the Maryland legislature, which called for an annual payment by the company to the city government from the Consolidated Gas Company, which is what it was called at the time, of $10,000 a year and 3% of all dividends declared in return for the privilege of enjoying a 25-year monopoly. So basically, the politicians conspired with this company to create a monopoly and then to share in the loot from the monopoly with the politicians. They would give the politicians $10,000 a year and 3% of all dividends declared each year, each and every year, in return for a 25-year monopoly, which of course had been renewed many times over. And so it was essentially a form of tax collection that was created. And what I found in my research is that this was done over and over and over again all over the country, which is not atypical. You know, once this sort of gang of crooks figured out how to create a monopoly under the shadow or under the fog of the public interest, other politicians in other states and other countries copied them and did the same thing. And another economist who I ran across, who was very Austrian in his perspective, was a man named Horace Gray, who was the last generation. He was publishing in the 1940s, And he wrote an important article on called The Public Utility Concept. And there's an old journal called the Journal of Land Economics. It used to be called the Journal of Land and Public Utility Economics. And it's still out there. It's still an academic journal, Journal of Land Economics. And he surveyed the whole history of the public utility concept up to 1940. And what he found was that, you know, once this happened with natural gas and electricity, just about every industry in America was running to the state legislatures saying, me too, I'm a public utility. For example, this happened in the radio industry, real estate, milk, air transport, coal, oil, all the agricultural industries, and so forth. And to put this into historical perspective, during and after the American Civil War in the 1860s, and I've written a lot on this elsewhere, I call it the triumph of Hamiltonianism. Alexander Hamilton, America's first Treasury Secretary, is famous as being a mercantilist. His vision of America from an economic perspective was essentially British-style mercantilism with a cozy relationship between business and government, protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare subsidies, a central bank modeled after the Bank of England to finance all of these subsidies. And there was a political battle in America for about some 70 years or more over this. But the Civil War was the breaking point. And so during the American Civil War, we got 50% average tariff rates that lasted for 60 years after the war. We got the massive subsidies to the railroad corporations. We got the National Currency and Legal Tender Acts, which nationalized most of the money supply. And so it was the triumph of the Hamiltonian vision over the alternative free market, decentralist, Jeffersonian vision of politics and government. And so my take on this is that by the time you get to the late 19th century, this is the heyday of Hamiltonianism, the heyday of government and business working together to essentially rip off the customers by creating government grants of privilege, government monopoly grants. And the shameful record of much of the economics profession was to concoct excuses for it, the chief one of which was the theory of natural monopoly that was invented. In fact, by the time you get to by the way, the theory of natural monopoly came about after this all happened. It wasn't as though economists were saying, well, this is what's happening. Economies of scale are a dangerous thing. Therefore, we need the government to regulate these industries. The government stepped in already with these political deals of the sort that I mentioned in the state of Maryland. And then after that, economists came around and invented these theories to rationalize or justify the government grants of monopoly. And of course, the economists became advisors to government. They became advisors to the corporations, and they made good money doing so. They're paid much more than the minimum wage, typically, to do these things. And so by the time you get to the 1930s, really what you see is that the whole essence of the so-called New Deal in America was essentially the same economic philosophy as the natural monopoly philosophy, creating monopolies and cartels everywhere throughout the whole economy. In the U.S., the National Recovery Act in the 1930s, the NRA, was essentially an attempt to cartelize or monopolize the entire manufacturing sector of the economy. The rationale given for this by the Roosevelt administration was the cockeyed theory that low prices caused the Great Depression. Therefore, if the government forces up prices by intentionally creating monopoly, the Great Depression will end. Well, they did do that. They did force up prices, but the Great Depression didn't end as a result of that. But that was their crazy theory. And of course, the business people liked it. They suspended the antitrust laws and created government-sanctioned monopolies. And so a lot of the corporations, of course, like this because they got monopolies, which they like much better than competition, of course. And for example, there were price codes. The prices were all set by government bureaucrats, and there were thousands of price code police were hired by the federal government to make sure that no price cutting was going on. A great book on this is The Roosevelt Myth by John T. Flynn. If you want to read a good book about the stormtroopers of the price code police, it's an old classic. It was written during that era. But John T. Flynn is a famous old right theorist. And so I would recommend that book if you want to read something about this. I talk about it also in my book, How Capitalism Saved America, in a chapter on the New Deal. Agriculture was the same thing. In the United States in the 1930s, agriculture was cartelized with the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. This is where the government massively increased the whole business of ordering farmers to plant fewer crops, to raise less livestock, and paying them for not growing food under the theory that if we increase the price of food, farm incomes will go up, and therefore the suffering of the farmers during the Great Depression will be alleviated. Now, that was basically the theory. Both of these programs, the National Recovery Act and the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, were ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1935, but then FDR responded to that by his attempt to pack the Supreme Court by adding six new members. That failed, but he succeeded in intimidating the Supreme Court sufficiently so that these types of things were ruled later on by a new Supreme Court to be okay, to be constitutionally kosher. And so Roosevelt won anyway, even though he didn't succeed in packing the Supreme Court. And so this all comes from this natural monopoly idea that government created and supervised monopolies in the public interest is a good thing. And it was always a cynical attempt by business to recruit government to create monopoly power through regulation and to employ economists and others to create a fog in the eyes of the public, fog of theory in the eyes of the public, to make them think that monopoly and high prices were really in their best interest. And that's essentially what they did. Another aspect of all this that I should mention, because I like to try to combine a study of economic history and the theory at the same time, is when a lot of big businesses were big supporters of government regulation of all kinds, not just natural monopoly regulation, but food and drug regulation, antitrust regulation. You had, not all businesses, but some. And there are two excellent books on this. One is In Restraint of Trade by Butler Schaefer, which I think is online at Mises.org. And the other is The Triumph of Conservatism by Gabriel Kolko, spelled K-O-L-K-O. And these two books give chapter and verse of the story of how big business in America wanted government regulation in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, just like they wanted natural monopoly regulations, like AT&T and the other big utilities wanted it because it was a monopoly. It was creating a monopoly for them. But these other forms of regulation, not natural monopoly regulation, but food and drug regulation, the idea was the bigger businesses always understood that they could probably control the regulatory process. They could capture the regulatory process. And therefore, they could use regulation to, if not to create outright monopolies, to impose much higher costs on their smaller competitors and on their potential competitors than they would pay. And so if they couldn't use these regulations to create a monopoly per se, they could use them to gain market share and to impose burdens, disproportionate burdens on their competitors and on their would-be competitors and potential competitors. And as I said, these two books tell this whole story, chapter and verse, about this. So this all fits into the story of sort of the success of Hamiltonianism in America. And of course, all these bad ideas were copied by other countries around the world and are still being copied by other countries around the world. In fact, when George Stigler, the late George Stigler of the University of Chicago, won the Nobel Prize in Economics, I think it was It was in the early 80s, around 1983, something like that, 82 or 83. One of the things was cited was his early studies on the economics of regulation. And there's I'll give you a citation, George Stigler and Claire Friedland. This is one of the articles that was cited in his Nobel Prize award. It's called What Can Regulators Regulate? The Case of Electricity. It was in the Journal of Law and Economics in 1962. And basically what George Stigler and his co-author Claire Friedland found was that after public utility regulation, natural monopoly regulation, was put into place in the electric power industry, prices went up, not down, even though it was all done in the name of consumer protection and reducing prices. And so, and that's where the idea of the capture theory of regulation comes, where the industry, the electric power industry, captured the regulatory authority and used regulation to create monopoly power and higher prices. There's another economist who was actually a student of Stigler's. His name is Greg Jarrell, J-A-R-R-E-L-L, who also wrote in the Journal of Law and Economics in 1978 of how originally a lot of the regulation of electricity was done by local governments, but then it was taken over by state governments. The argument was made that the states will do a better job. Yeah, we know that prices have gone up. Well, that's because the local governments have done a bad job of regulating. And so in almost every state in the U.S., the state governments took over. And as a result, prices went up by 46%. So the state governments did even worse from the perspective of the consumer. And it sort of makes sense because it's, you know, as bad as the local governments reform, the voters can still keep a closer eye on the local politicians, the mayor and the city council. But way back, you know, off into the hinterlands in the state capital, they can't keep quite as close an eye on them. And then, of course, Washington, D.C. is even more remote to most Americans. And so local government is always easier to keep an eye on. And for that reason, it is sometimes less corrupt, less inefficient, not always, though, to be sure. And so the economics profession invented this bogus theory of natural monopoly to justify what had already happened. And there were other justifications that were created by the economics profession, too, for this. And one of them was the excessive duplication argument. That, you know, if you had two electric power companies or two phone companies, it would be excessive competition. They called it the duplication of facilities problem. But it's so transparent, though, if you think about it. You know, the fact that we have Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, and Toyota is a duplication of the facilities that they have for producing automobiles, but that ignores the whole idea of the process of competition that is created by this duplication. But it was looked at as, you know, why do we need, we're wasting resources by having three producers of electricity instead of just one producer of electricity. And of course, the companies like that argument because it supported the idea of a government-controlled monopoly. Yeah. And Murray Rothbard wrote about this too, in Man, Economy, and State, among other places, where he was always brilliant at pinpointing the essential problem with these things. And so, you know, there's concern about excessive facilities, digging up the streets to put power lines in, would, you know, make a big mess in the cities. And here's what Rothbard said about this, is about the root problem here, which is not excessive competition. He said, the fact that the government must give permission for the use of its streets, that is to put power lines in, for example, has been cited to justify stringent government regulations of public utilities, many of which, like water or electric companies, must make use of the streets. The regulations are then treated as a voluntary quid pro quo, but to do so overlooks the fact that governmental ownership of the streets is itself a permanent act of intervention. Regulation of public utilities or of any other industry discourages investment in these industries, thereby depriving consumers of the best satisfaction of their wants, for it distorts the resource allocation of the free market. So it's the socialized streets that is the root of a problem here with regard to excessive duplication of electric power companies and things of that sort. And so, so that's how he dealt with that, that issue. And there's another aspect of the natural monopoly story that is usually ignored. It doesn't appear in the textbooks very much at all, the economics textbooks, but there's literature on it. And there's been literature on this for many, many decades. And it's something called competition for the field. That is, if an alternative to granting a monopoly is to have sort of more or less a competitive bidding for the right to supply water, electricity, or something like that. And the theory behind this, and this is used in France, there have been some studies of how this has been used for many years in France in the water supply industry. The idea is if cities are going to get involved, or governments are going to get involved, they don't necessarily have to create one company, give it a franchise monopoly forever, and then allow politics to give us the result of monopoly pricing. It is conceivable to have competitive bidding, and so even if you do grant a monopoly that gets the grant is the one that puts in the lowest bid and promises to charge the lowest prices, and then you make it a 3 or 5 year contract. And again, Harold Demsetz wrote about that. He had an article that's pretty well known to researchers in this area, economic researchers. It's called Why Regulate Utilities, and it was in the Journal of Law and Economics way back in 1968. But actually, the idea was written up much earlier than that by Edwin Chadwick, a British economist, way back in 1859. And so Demsetz sort of updated William Chadwick's idea that's called competition for the field. Okay, so that's another critique. Another piece of literature here that's very interesting, I studied this many years ago when I was in graduate school, in fact, is there's an economist from the University of Illinois. His name is Walter Primeau, spelled P-R-I-M-E-A-U-X, a French-sounding name. He's an American, but he's a French-sounding name. And he's written a book called Direct Utility Competition, The Natural Monopoly Myth. And in it, I was familiar with his research when it was all being published in the academic journals, and then he turned it into this book. And what he basically was saying was that, oh, wait a minute, there are several dozen cities in America that did not go along with the creation of franchise monopolies. There have always been these several dozen cities that have allowed direct competition head-to-head with several electric power companies. Not the situation of where one company has a monopoly in the east part of town and the other company has a monopoly in the western section of the town. No, there's direct head-to-head competition for all customers in the city in a couple of dozen cities. And so this provided sort of an experimental laboratory for Walter Primeau. And he was one of the few that ever really looked into this. And he wrote a number of statistical studies that I remember reading in graduate school way back when the dinosaurs still roamed the earth in places like Econometrica and the Journal of the American Statistical Association, and journals like that. And here are some of the things he found that shouldn't be too shocking to an Austrian economist who understands competition as a dynamic rivalrous process. He found that direct rivalry between two competing firms has existed for very long periods of time. The rival electric utilities compete vigorously. How about that? Through prices and services, customers have gained substantial benefits from competition. Who would ever have thought? Contrary to natural monopoly theory, costs are actually lower where there are two firms operating. The theory says if you allow two firms, they'll split the market and neither of them will be able to achieve the economy to scale by moving down that long-run average cost curve and having a large output level. But that ignores the fact that the process of competition induces people to figure out ways of cutting costs, whereas monopoly does the opposite. So the creation of all these government-controlled monopolies actually created inefficiency, not efficiency, just exactly the opposite of the standard natural monopoly story. The theory of natural monopoly fails, Primeau writes, on every count. Competition exists, price wars are not serious. That is, they'll lead to bankruptcy of everyone. There is better consumer service and lower prices with competition. What a remarkable outcome that is. Competition persists for very long periods of time. And guess what? Consumers themselves prefer competition. He also concludes that the managers of these companies, however, preferred monopoly to competition. And I don't know why he had to say that, but he did in his actual book. And so, you know, this sounds, you know, to people who aren't used to reading this literature and getting involved in economics literature, this must sound awfully simple-minded. But all of these conclusions are based on many, many articles published in prestigious statistical journals and like Econometrica, you know, one of the top journals in the economics profession to establish this. But it's been mostly ignored. If you went to a university library and picked out the microeconomics books in the library, very few of them, if any of them, will mention any of this in this research that's out there. Okay. Of course, in recent years, a lot of states in the U.S. have tried to have talked about deregulation of some of the utilities. But in most cases, it has been just a re-regulation or a different kind of regulation. And so the politicians have, I'll give you an example of how this has worked here in the state where I am, the state of Maryland. In the year 2000, we're in like the 100th year of the government-run monopoly for electric power in the year 2000. The legislature, the state legislature, passed what it called a deregulation law. And they said, you know, we would like more companies than just this one that's been here for 100 years to offer electric power for sale in Maryland. And so we are going to deregulate by allowing anyone to come in and compete if they want. However, they said we will control the price of electricity for the next 6 years. And that price will be at the 1996 price, not even the year 2000 price, because the year 1996 price was much lower. And so here they go. They say, we're going to control the price. There's price controls, which is a form of regulation. We're going to call this deregulation. So we're going to call price regulation deregulation. And then we're going to pretend that power companies from all over the world are going to want to come into Maryland knowing that they can't charge a high enough price to make a profit because we are controlling the price at the 1996 level. And then, of course, the 6 years passed and no new companies entered the market. They would have been very foolish to have done so. And the same legislature then declares deregulation to be a failure. It was the front page news in the local papers for months at a time. And I actually wrote a paper, an article in the Baltimore Examiner, which no longer exists, was a competing newspaper to the Baltimore Sun, entitled "What Deregulation?" Pointing out the facts that I just mentioned. And a lot of states do the same sort of thing. They just change the kind of regulation, but they call it deregulation in order to discredit the idea of free markets and free market competition in electric power, because politicians never want to give up their control and their power. Ever. Cable TV is also a classic example of how this operated. If you read what I wrote in my article that's on the syllabus, a classic example would be Washington, D.C., where all the surrounding suburbs by the early 80s had cable television, but Washington, D.C. did not, because there were about 10 companies that were bidding for the right to be the monopoly supplier of cable television in Washington, D.C. And they had spent years and years wining and dining all the politicians, and taking them out to fancy resorts, contributing large amounts of money to their political careers and so forth. And so the politicians were all just enjoying this, being showered with money and invitations to Hawaii, to the International Cable Television Convention, and things like that. But the public was up in arms over this. And they provided enough criticism, put enough heat on the politicians that they finally had to make a decision. And they finally did assign one company the monopoly right to be to be the supplier of cable TV services. And if anyone wants to really do some research on this, probably the best free market economist who has done some really nice writing on it is Thomas Hazlett, spelled H-A-Z-L-E-T-T. I think I mentioned him last week also, but he wrote some great articles in the economics journals about this. So what happened in Washington, D.C. was the mayor and the mayor's staff and members of the city council were all given shares of stock in the company that was eventually awarded the monopoly franchise. And they were given shares of stock before the award was made. And so I can recall reading in the papers. I was living in the D.C. suburbs at the time in Virginia when I was teaching at George Mason. And I can recall reading that some of the members of the mayor's staff within just 3 or 4 years cashed in their stock for about $15 million, $15 million. And so this was how it works. They were literally paid the politicians, through the back door, indirectly, to be given a monopoly franchise. And this happened city after city after city in cable TV. And one of the things Thomas Hazlett found is that just like electricity, there had been for many years competing companies in cable TV service. And guess what? You get lower prices, more channels, better service when there's competition. And so all of this busts up the myth of natural monopoly. Even the story of how AT&T came to be a monopoly provider of long-distance telephone services in America for many, many years, decades, really busts apart the myth of natural monopoly. And how it came about was there was vigorous competition. There were hundreds of phone companies in the early 20th century. During World War I, the U.S. government nationalized the telephone industry. They claimed that they wanted to eavesdrop on all, censor all telephone conversations. So they just took it over. And then after World War I, they didn't return the companies to the free market. After AT&T's patents expired in the year 1893, there was a flood of competition in the telephone business. But by the time you get to the post-World War I era, 1920, the federal government handed the monopoly power over to the state governments, and each state created a monopoly, an AT&T monopoly within that state. And so this was a super act of rent-seeking on the part of AT&T to be given a monopoly in each state. And so each state regulated the telephone monopoly. So this was not a free market. This was all created by government. And then, of course, technology finally broke it up by the time you get to the 1980s and 1990s. Satellite technology and other technology has broken up that monopoly. But for all those years, 1920 to roughly 1990 almost, 1980s is when it was deregulated. It was a monopoly all that time. Okay, and so that's the story of natural monopoly that I wanted to tell. And so it's an interesting thing that this whole era, this whole period of history, that we had, we went from the 19th century where all the economics profession was pretty much in line with the Austrians and how they think about monopoly. Then once the profession abandoned that, not only did they make the mistakes of criticizing the markets as failing by falling into the trap of the Nirvana fallacy, but they became excuse makers for real monopoly. So the economics profession attacked free market competition while making excuses and rationales for monopoly, and all the while claiming to be champions of competition. And it really is a bizarre thing. I guess the most charitable thing you can say is they were confused. They abandoned the Austrian way of thinking about markets, and that led to massive confusion by embracing this more or less engineering concept of markets based on increasing, decreasing, and constant returns to scale as measures of monopoly power, for example, market structure, as opposed to rivalry, entrepreneurship, price cutting, product differentiating, advertising, all the tools of competition. And so the most charitable thing you can say is that they threw away a good theory and adopted a bad theory. Although George Stigler, the late George Stigler, did say about economists who became enthusiastic about antitrust regulation, in an article he wrote in the American Economic Review once, he said they learned that they could make more than the minimum wage as antitrust consultants. And so he had sort of impugned their motives and claimed that they were just bought out by the government and by companies who hired them as antitrust consultants. And some of that does happen, of course, but I think a big part of it also is the abandonment of the Austrian way of thinking about markets that led to the big problems here. And so I think that's about all I wanted to say for now. I covered a lot of ground, I think, in a short amount of time. And so let's move to any questions anybody has about on the chat area, and I'll keep chatting if you want me to. And I'll just wait like I usually do to see if we get some questions. So Christina, how exactly are the antitrust laws a source of monopoly power? I understand how they restrain output and productivity growth and how they lead to higher prices, but I'm not sure if the line of reasoning continues from there. Well, how the antitrust laws are a source of monopoly power, well, for example, there are many, many ways in which they are a source of monopoly power by outlawing competitive business practices. There's one article, for example, it's in the literature, it's called Antitrust Pork Barrel by Robert Collison and several other authors. It's in the book, The Political Economy of Antitrust, which I've mentioned in a previous week. And it's a statistical study. And basically, the story that is told there is that how a lot of antitrust regulation comes about is two companies propose a merger. And it is obvious to everybody else in the industry, if these two companies merge, they will be superior to everyone else. They will be able to produce at lower cost and will probably come up with better quality products. That's what competition is supposed to do. So the merger itself is a competitive act that will lead to lower cost and or better products and please consumers take market share away from other companies. The other companies there then will go to the legislature, go to Congress, get their member of Congress or their senator from their state to intervene at the Federal Trade Commission or at the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department to stop the merger, get the regulators to stop the merger. Why do they want to stop the merger? Well, the merger will lead to lower prices. We can't have that because we are incapable or unwilling to drop our prices. And so that's a classic example. Another example is the Microsoft case. I mentioned a book earlier in an earlier class called Pride Before the Fall by John Heilemann. I think he spells his name H-E-I-L-E-M-A-N-N. He's a journalist from California, Silicon Valley. He documented the whole story of how the Microsoft antitrust case was actually put together by Microsoft's competitors, the Novell Corporation especially, because Microsoft was competing too successfully. They wanted to hamstring Microsoft. And so, and as we read, you know, next week, I put several chapters of Dominic Armentano's short book on antitrust on there. And there's other examples that answer this question on there. But that's a classic case of how it happens, is that businesses run to the government to try to stop their competitors from doing something that would be good for customers, good for consumers, but bad for the competitors. And that doesn't necessarily create a monopoly, which is the textbook definition of a single seller, but it does interfere with competition. And antitrust has always been used to do that. So can an owner of an entire supply of water in a region be considered a natural monopolist? Well, you know, you could talk about hypothetical examples all year long, but I prefer to talk about reality. And you know, there's never been a free market owner of all the water supply in an area. That only occurs under socialism, where the government can use the coercive powers of the state to prohibit anybody else from offering water supply. But you know, even if somebody did have most of the water supply, that creates and charges a high price for it. that creates an incentive for others to find ways to deliver water to that area. And that'll include technology and transportation and so forth. So that's how the free market would work. The only way you could have, you know, one sort of James Bond monopoly character monopolizing the water supply is under socialism, not in the free market. Let's see what else we have here. From Christina also, what kind of reform do Chicago school economists propose these days? Is any such proposal futile because ultimately rests on a perfect competition model? Well, that is one big difference between the Chicago school and the Austrian school, is the Chicago school still looks at the perfect competition model, competitive equilibrium, as the benchmark of competition. The Austrians don't. And so that's why your typical Chicago school economist who studies antitrust is not in favor of abolishing antitrust. They have all sorts of proposals they make over the years to regulate in a different way, but they don't see it as inherently incompatible with competition. Even though the late George Stigler, who was one of the big shots for many, many years in the Chicago School, he once wrote that a typical Chicago school view. He once wrote that a competitive economy, perfect competition, not a competitive economy, but perfect competition requires a Sherman Act, because many firms is the defining characteristic of perfect competition. And so you need a Sherman Act to force many firms into existence. That's a classic Chicago view. That was in an article by George Stigler entitled Perfect Competition Historically Contemplated. It was published in the Journal of Political Economy way back in 1965. But that was sort of a classic statement of the Chicago School view of things. And so they'll make recommendations. They've done hundreds of studies of why restrictions on mergers are a bad idea, because they restrict economies of scale and efficiency. They'll defend tie-in sales. For example, there have been laws against tie-in sales. An example of that would be if you buy a fishing pole with a fishing reel attached to it, the reel is tied in to the fishing pole, that's a tie-in sale. And for years, the antitrust authorities investigated that sort of thing. They thought there's something, somebody's up to no good here by not selling the fishing rod separately from the fishing reel. But of course, somebody does. If one company is selling fishing poles that have the reel part of it attached to it, there are other places you can go and buy them separately if you want. There's a lot of competition out there. And so the Chicago School economists have pointed out the sort of the futility or silliness of this type of regulation, and have advocated all sorts of deregulation of that sort. Don't regulate that. Don't regulate price discrimination. Don't regulate predatory pricing, which we're going to talk about next week. However, they buy into the idea that there was a golden age of antitrust, which I talked about and debunked last week, I think. And so we need antitrust to have perfect competition. The two things the Chicago School differs from, really, most Austrian economists, is antitrust and central banking. You won't find too many, if any, abolitionists or advocates of free banking from the Chicago School, the standard Chicago School. For some reason, they believe we always needed a Fed and we always needed antitrust. But most Austrians would disagree with that because of a different view of competition. Let's see what else we have here. Is network externalities a factor in telephone competition, or must each telephone company pass on calls? Network externalities, it's a factor, I guess, in telephone competition. I don't know if each company must pass on calls as far as that goes. But there was a big deal made about network externalities creating monopoly power some years ago, but it's pretty much been determined that it's not a big problem. The classic book on this is Winners, Losers, and Microsoft, which I think I mentioned last week, by Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis. Winners, Losers, and Microsoft. And Liebowitz and Margolis started doing some very important research on network effects 30 years ago. They were writing about it. And Liebowitz himself, by the way, was writing about the impending housing, bursting of the housing bubble long before it burst. He's really the only one of the very few non-Austrians that I could think of who did that. And even though he's a fellow traveler sympathetic to Austrian economics, he doesn't really call himself one. And so this is a great book if you want to read up on network effects as far as that goes. The Austrians are not the only economists who have claimed who want to repeal the antitrust legislation. There are some Austrian economists who won't say this. They'll say, I'm just a scientist. I'm an economist. And it is true, economics per se doesn't say whether you should or should not repeal antitrust laws. But if some of us make the case that not only is this really bad for the economy, but it's an interference in property rights too. It's an act of theft of property rights when the government steps in and controls how you can use your property. And so some of us are not shy about calling for the repeal of antitrust laws. But there have been other economists. I think I did mention in this course once, Lester Thoreau, the former dean of the management school at MIT, who wrote about this. And he wrote a lot about Japan in the 1980s and the 1970s, for that matter. And he understood that, the Japanese did not have antitrust laws, anything at all like the United States. And so a lot of the mergers and a lot of the business practices and a lot of the cooperation between businesses in the automobile industry in Japan and other industries in Japan, which never would have been legal here in the United States at that time, were routine practices that led to the great success of Japanese microelectronics and automobile industries. So Lester Thoreau, the dean of management at MIT, and a very prominent liberal left-wing economist, advocated in a book that was published in the late 1980s, the complete abolition of antitrust laws. And so it's not just the Austrians. There have been some honest scholars of different schools of thought who have recognized what a bad idea antitrust regulation is. Let's see, Christina, how is the industry defined in antitrust cases or to calculate concentration ratios? It is arbitrary. Yeah, the first thing they have to do is define the industry because, there can be lots of close substitutes for all sorts of products and services. And so they do it, but it is arbitrary. One of the things they do, for example, in antitrust cases, one of the things that could be argued, as a principle of microeconomics has to do with elasticity of demand, the demand curve and the pricing by a monopolist. And so, monopolist, the theory basically says a monopolist will want to price in the inelastic part of the demand curve. And if it's inelastic, there are a few substitutes. And so there are arguments about that. If they go to court, they'll argue about the elasticity of demand. And, if it's elastic, there are lots of substitutes, or less easy substitutes. And so if that's true, there's no monopoly power. And so there usually will be a discussion of that, of the how elastic is the demand for the product. And then they get into cross-price elasticities. That's the way they, that is the percentage change in quantity demanded of product X given a percentage change in the price of good Y, some other good, that is a substitute good. It's a way of getting at how easy it is to substitute between good X and good Y. And so they get bogged down in discussions of substitutability and trying to find, well, just what is the market for this good? One of the things the Austrians look at it, though, is that, you know, let's say there is a monopoly in ice cream. The substitutes aren't just yogurt and you know whatever a close substitute, other close substitute for ice cream would be. Substitutes could include bus fare, steak, a baseball glove, anything you spend your money on. It's not just the things that are direct substitutes for that. You know, if you see ice cream, there's an ice cream monopoly and they're charging $20 for one scoop of ice cream, you don't have to go anywhere near an ice cream store. You can spend that $20 on all sorts of things and not even a food item. And so the Austrians look at this much more broadly than most economists do. And if you look at it that way, it makes it even more remotely likely that there could be a free market ice cream monopolist or any other kind of monopolist out there, because we do have the ability, we consumers, if we don't like it, if we don't think it's worth the money, go somewhere else. And the act of going somewhere else will make the demand curve for that product much more elastic. And therefore, you know, even the standard economic theory would say there's no monopoly here. And so, yeah, the concentration ratios Christina is asking about, well, those are arbitrary too. For years and years, 60% poor firm concentration ratio was just used by the government as an arbitrary, out-of-the-blue number. If you had four firms that had 60% of the market, for whatever reason, they had better watch out because they might be sued by the U.S. government for conspiracies and restraint of trade, even if the U.S. government had no evidence whatsoever of any kind of conspiracy. They would go on fishing expeditions, witch hunts, if you will, just based on that arbitrary number. It's not 59% or 55%. 60% was the magic number for some reason for many years, and it's all arbitrary. And not only that, but the concentration ratios did not consider international competition. They were only based on domestic competition or potential competition, that is entry. You know, if you did have a monopoly, you're making above the average profits, competition is going to come from all over the world, but none of that was considered by these concentration ratios at all. That was always a deep flaw of the whole idea. But governments always want to use statistics of some kind to justify what they're doing. They always want statistics. That's why they gather so many statistics. They think it helps them centrally plan the economy. One more from Christina. At what stage was economic theory when the Sherman Act was passed? That was actually the subject of my first lecture. With the time the Sherman Act was passed, the whole economics profession thought of competition like the Austrians do. For example, the article that I put on the reading list for tonight, my article entitled The Myth of Natural Monopoly, the first several pages, the first major section is called Economies of Scale During the Franchise Monopoly Era. And I quote a lot of the economists at the time of the Sherman Act as saying that large-scale production, mergers, economies of scale are nothing to worry about. They're actually, in fact, good things. And I published another article that I don't think it's online unless you get on JSTOR. It's called Antitrust and Competition Historically Considered. It was in a journal called Economic Inquiry in July of 1988, way back when, with a co-author, Jack High. And we surveyed all the economists who had jobs as professional economists in the around the 1890 period, which was only a couple dozen in the whole United States at the time. And we found that all, with just one exception, they all looked at competition like the Austrians do, as a dynamic, rivalrous, ongoing process of entrepreneurship, and they were all opposed to antitrust regulation in principle. They thought antitrust was inherently incompatible with competition, and we only found one counterexample of that, of all of them. Even Richard T. Ely, the very socialistic co-founder of the American Economic Association, was opposed to the Sherman Act. he thought it was inherently incompatible with competition as he understood it. And that all changed by about the 1930s. There's a famous book that Frank Knight of the University of Chicago wrote in the 1930s entitled Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit. And in it, he laid out, as of that time, as I think it might have been 1930, as of that time, the thinking on this perfect competition model. And so by the time you get to the 1920s and 30s, the mathematization of economics had been occurring. Economics had been changing. It was trying to ape itself into a physical science, relying heavily on calculus and abandoning the old ways of studying markets. And so, and one of the consequences of this was the development of this perfect competition model. And so by, as of around 1930, you had old Frank Knight, who was the James Buchanan's professor. One of my professors in graduate school was James Buchanan, who won the Nobel Prize in 1986. And Frank Knight was one of his professors at the University of Chicago in his day. But that all changed around the 1930s. And so the Austrian view, markets didn't change, but the economic thinking about what markets are changed. And that's where we came into a lot of the nonsense that I've been alluding to the past several weeks. Let's see. When the Sherman Act was passed, the economics profession was against it, period. Bill, to all panelists, where there is competition between public utilities, are there duplication of lines in the case of electricity or pipes and gas? Walter Primo is the expert on that, the book I mentioned, Direct Utility Competition. And he points out how they work these things out. You know, no one wants to have the streets dug up forever and the ugliness of competing lines. And so, when they, in these cities that he writes about that have had direct utility competition for many, many years, he writes that they work out a way to avoid the ugliness of multiple lines and all that. And so, so that's what I would recommend if you really wanted to answer that question, Walter Primo's book, Direct Utility Competition. But the ultimate problem is the government ownership of the streets. They're not private streets. And so that means the streets are zero priced, and anything that's zero priced is overused. And so when you have congestion problems and pollution problems and problems of ugliness, it's often because of the resource is a zero price, which many government resources are, because there's no market. And as the Rothbard quote that I read earlier says, that's the root of the problem here, not the fact that there's competition. Okay, let's see. Can you still hear me? My screen changed a little bit. Kind of lost the Q&A here. The Mises Institute to all participants, yes. I'm not sure what the question is. Okay, I can hear me. Any other questions? I lost my mugshot on my computer, but I hope you can still hear me. Basic text for I/O. Let's see, there aren't any good texts for I/O. The best basic text would be Dominic Armentano's book, Antitrust and Monopoly, as far as I'm concerned, and also Power and Market by Rothbard, and articles from Man, Economy, and State on markets and monopoly and that sort of thing. I think that would be the best way to use a text. Okay, anything else? Let's see what we got here. Any further questions? I guess pretty soon there's another class coming on, I think, that Danny will be working on. Let's see, here's a, for the Mises Institute, did the institutionalists have an impact on the move to antitrust? I think they did. The origins of antitrust, the institutionalists weren't even around then, but by the time you get to the 20th century, I think they were probably active. Richard T. Ely is sort of considered one of the godfathers of the institutionalists, and he was opposed to antitrust, but some of his sort of intellectual heirs became more friendly to antitrust. But Ely himself was not. And one expert among Austrians is Pete Betke at George Mason University. He's written a lot over the years on institutionalists, but I haven't. That's not one of my areas of expertise. I do know that Ely was opposed to antitrust. I'm assuming everyone can still hear me. Well, it looks like we're winding down here, folks. And so I guess it's about time to call it a night then. I don't see any more. There's one by Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman studied under Frank Knight. Friedman was there around that time. Buchanan got his degree after World War II, and Frank Knight was still there at Chicago at that time. And so they were contemporaries. Another big shot at Chicago was Aaron Director, who was actually Friedman's father-in-law. Milton Friedman's wife, Rose, was her father, Aaron Director, and he was one of the early, he was a contemporary of Frank Knight at the University of Chicago. A lot of these old Chicago economists, if you look at their writings, they were very, very interventionist. It tells you how interventionist the mainstream of the economics profession was if the Chicago school people were considered to be laissez-faire or free market. They advocated all sorts of interventions. Irving Fisher was another Chicago school star in the early days during the Great Depression, and he was a prohibitionist. He advocated alcohol prohibition. And all kinds of other interventions too. But compared to the rest of the economics profession, people like this were considered to be pretty mild interventionists at the time. So it wasn't too unusual that Ludwig von Mises is said to have said at an early meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society in the 1940s, you're all a bunch of socialists, because there was a debate over the proper degree of income redistribution by the state. And the two sides were, one side thought there should be more than exists now, and the other side thought there should be less than exists now. And of course, Mises thought there should be none. And so Milton Friedman has said on several occasions publicly that Mises stormed out of the meeting and said, you're all a bunch of socialists. And they were talking like socialists about income redistribution through the tax system. But Friedman was apparently put off by that for the rest of his whole life. He kept mentioning it for decades after it happened. I think it was 1948 when it happened. See, any other questions, folks? Okay, I guess we can call it a night then. A lot of frank nights. Thanks again for participating. I hope you learned a few things and have a great week. We have one more class and have a good week. And I'll make up an exam for anyone who wants to get a grade along with your certificate after the last class. And take care. Have a good night.